ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays.
We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is.
It's serious reporting on global events. Plus you're invited for a daily radio coffee table chat with me, Geraldine Doogue.
And with me, Hamish McDonald. And in 2026, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Together we'll explore the global forces reshaping our world in mostly calm conversation.
Calm, Geraldine. Global roaming. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a war raging in Europe. The Russia-Ukraine conflict has reshaped everything from European defence spending to the Eurovision Song Contest. But the fighting in Kyiv and Donbass is also a spiritual civil war, tearing the Eastern Orthodox communion apart. Hi, this is Soul Search, the show about how we make and find meaning. I'm Rowan Salmond. On one side of the conflict, Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople is first among equals of the heads of the various Orthodox national churches and the spiritual leader of global Orthodoxy. On the other, Patriarch Kirill of Moscow is leader of the Russian Orthodox Church. It's by far the largest single Orthodox denomination in the world. Kirill supports Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Bartholomew vehemently opposes it. And in 2019, he granted the Ukrainian Orthodox Church independence from Moscow against Kirill's wishes. It's a conflict that cuts to the heart of Eastern Orthodox Christian identity. But the two sides do hold certain things in common, including a book, the Philokalia. In contrast to the violence and turmoil of the war, the Philokalia holds what many consider to be the true spiritual essence of Orthodoxy, stillness and ceaseless prayer. Jonathan Zecker is co-translator of a new translation of the Philokalia and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University. Thanks for speaking with me, Jonathan.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Jonathan, can you explain why this war is a spiritual conflict as well as a political one?
Russia and Ukraine share not only the religion of Christianity, broadly speaking, but really that form that we call Eastern Orthodox Christianity. For a long time, Ukraine was even under the same head of church, the same patriarch, the Moscow patriarch. Increasingly, as Ukraine became more culturally and politically independent, so too have its churches become more independent, and there is a Ukrainian Orthodox Church. But fundamentally, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church and the Greek Orthodox Church and all the others are, or are at least meant to be, one and the same church. And so when Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, it began a war between people who are, religiously speaking, brothers and sisters. Mm. And this came as a shock and a horror to church leaders, many of whom have condemned and opposed the war, with the exception being the Patriarch of Moscow and a couple others. But by and large, within the Orthodox world, this is seen as a kind of civil war, not to say that Ukraine is part of Russia, but within the church, a kind of civil war.
Because Kyiv is very important to Russian Orthodox Christians, isn't it?
Well, Kyiv is perhaps ironically the source of Russian Orthodox history.
Really?
It begins there, yeah, with Prince Volodymyr of Kyiv and the mass conversion of, what is it, 987, 988. And Orthodox Christianity is taken up by Russian or Kievan envoys who had visited Constantinople. And when Prince Volodymyr converts, this begins the rise of this form of Christianity in Slavic lands, but at that point there wasn't a place called Russia per se. So Kyiv is the first focal point of Orthodoxy in the Slavic world.
Mm. And this would be why, you know, a few weeks ago, the Russian Secret Service called Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew an antichrist and said that he has dismembered Orthodox Ukraine. I mean, what's going on there?
This is because of his opposition to the war and his support for an autocephalous, which is to say self-determining, Ukrainian Orthodox Church.
Like independent, kind of.
Independent of Moscow.
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Autocephalous simply means that that church has the right to elect its own patriarch or chief bishop. Mm. So the Russian church is autocephalous and its patriarch is in Moscow. The Ukrainian church, if it is autocephalous, it would have its patriarch in Kyiv and it would be responsible. It would be independent, as you say. And the ecumenical patriarch has been very much in support of this, in part as an opposition to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so no wonder that the Russian Foreign Service would call him an antichrist and suggest that he has dismembered Orthodox Christianity because he has supported what they would see as a schism in what they see as a single Russian church, whereas for Ukrainians, that is not the case. And for other Orthodox Christians, that is not the case.
There's a sort of undercurrent of nationalism in Orthodox Christianity, or at least it appears that way from the outside.
There absolutely can be. I think oftentimes it aligns very deeply with nationalist sentiment. And this in part is due to the history of the countries that are Orthodox today, places like Greece, Serbia, Romania, Bulgaria. They're ability to become independent nations, especially emerging from rule by the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, was bound up with their sense of identity as Christians and specifically as Orthodox Christians. And so there has for a long time been a real unity between nationalist aspirations and the kind of cultural identity that goes with being Orthodox. At the same time, as these countries have seen their people go throughout the world, and especially into places like North America, Western Europe, and Australia, we see that it's more than just nationalism, that to be Orthodox isn't simply to be Greek or Serbian or Ukrainian or Russian. It's to be something that kind of transcends those national identities. And so there's also been a strong move to kind of condemn what was called ethnophiletism, which is to say a sort of understanding of religious identity as ethnic identity.
Mm. And what's the relationship like between Orthodox Christianity and other streams of Christianity?
It varies. Mm-hmm. The closest is undoubtedly with Roman Catholicism, especially from the Vatican II onward. And there have been a lot of movements in ecumenical dialogue, a lot of good relationships, especially between recent popes and the current ecumenical patriarch, Bartholomew.
Which is kind of, it's a bit surprising, actually, given the history of these two churches.
Oh, the history has for a long time been one of fierce competition.
Yes.
And that was certainly true when the Byzantine Empire or the East Roman Empire was thriving and later declining, as the smaller nations of Western Europe and the Holy Roman Empire were ascending in power. And that competition was particularly fierce, which is why we have the Great Schism of 1054 and the kind of complete split between the churches in 1204 when Western Christian Crusaders capture and sack Christian Constantinople. So not the last time that Christians have invaded other Christians in the name of a religious war, but certainly a shocking moment. And yet, despite all of that, they share so much in common, so much love of deep tradition, of even of similar liturgies. So there are certainly Byzantine rites and Russian-style rites within the Catholic Church. And there's a lot of overlap and a lot of common ground for theological and really prayerful conversation between the two. So there's a good deal of room for growth in unity between the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox churches. And that's been developing over the last, especially 50, 60 years.
Mm. Just coming back to that idea of religious and ethnic identity bound up with each other and how, you know, that can sometimes lead to political conflict as well. I wonder if in the unraveling of that, you know, for example, with Russian Orthodox Christians who might have lived in the United States during the Cold War, and how that identity would have been very complicated. Is the ecumenical patriarch and also works like the Philokalia, does that serve to undermine or complicate that sort of nationalist undercurrent in Orthodox Christianity?
I think both offices like the ecumenical patriarch and shared texts like the Philokalia, as well as shared liturgy, which is something else one finds across the Orthodox world, fundamentally the same hymns, prayers, and rites being used everywhere. Those do contribute to a sense of unity that works against nationalist or ethnic difference. And I think, broadly speaking, that's important and necessary in the Eastern Orthodox world. There's always that tension between unity and diversity, where these texts and liturgies and even figures like the Ecumenical Patriarch contribute to a unity of, among Orthodox Christians that doesn't undermine real differences and doesn't say that people can't have their own kind of cultural idioms and communities, but that being Orthodox transcends those and embraces them. And I think that's what's so important. And here I think there's actually perhaps been more success, not only from shared liturgy, but from shared texts like the Philokalia, than there has been with a figure like the Ecumenical Patriarch, because the Ecumenical Patriarch is, on one level, always Greek. Being taken from, chosen from Greek-speaking Christians in Istanbul, needing to meet certain requirements and being associated. And there's always going to be that kind of challenge, like, well, how ecumenical, how global can this person be? Now, Bartholomew's done, I think, a fantastic job of embracing a really global identity, but at the same time, that person is always going to be somewhat limited, whereas a text like the Philokalia really does travel across borders and boundaries very, very well.
On Soul Search, I'm Rowan Salmond, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Zecker, who's co-translator of a new translation of a book cherished by Orthodox Christians on both sides of the war in Ukraine, the Philokalia. It's a rare bit of neutral ground in the conflict that's even found appreciation outside of the Orthodox Church.
So Philokalia means quite literally love of beauty. And this is true, that what is in this text that we're talking about, which is an anthology, what's in there is a collection of things that the editors thought were beautiful, that they were worth putting together. But it's also true that Philokalia in Greek also just means anthology. And so you put things together that you think are beautiful, thus Philokalia. And what it is an anthology. It's not a single work. It's 37 separate works that have been gathered together into one collection, and that presented as a unity.
What kind of texts are in it?
They're, generally speaking, monastic texts or texts from a monastic origin or by a monastic author, and they're usually about prayer. All the texts are about prayer in one form or another.
And do we know who wrote them?
Most of them, yes. Some of them, no. So a lot of the texts are by reasonably famous church fathers. So people like St. Maximus the Confessor, St. Gregory Palamas, and some others. Some are by less known but still known authors like St. Diaticus of Photiki or St. Mark the Solitary. And then others are either anonymous or traveled under other authors' names. So there's a work on the three methods of prayer attributed to Saint Simeon the New Theologian, but that is definitely not by Saint Simeon the New Theologian. It's by someone else.
Yes.
And that happens a lot. That happens all the time, that when a text is really good, people tend to associate it with someone famous. And so there's a lot of that happening.
I mean, that happens with books of the Bible as well. There's a lot that are attributed to Paul.
Attributed to Paul or all the Gospels. They all have names on them, and that's usually because they get associated with it. And that's well and good. I don't think that's a bad thing at all. With these texts, they've been gathered from across about 11 centuries, from the late 4th century, all the way up to after the end of the Byzantine Empire, the 16th century. So, and all sorts of things in between. So the 37 separate texts come from across more than a millennium of kind of monastic traditions of writing and prayer.
Mm. But it's not on the same level, so to speak, as the Bible. It's a resource rather than a sacred text.
I think that's absolutely right. Sometimes people will talk about the Philokalia as the Bible of Orthodox spirituality, and I always get a little annoyed because
risky
the Bible,
language, yes,
exactly. The Bible is the Bible of Orthodox spirituality,
yes.
But the Philokalia is an amazing resource that has had a huge impact in the spiritual practices and spiritual lives of Orthodox Christians around the world, and it espouses a form of prayer and practices of prayer that have come to be sort of the norms, or for a lot of Orthodox Christians, the norm of what they would think of as the right way to engage in personal prayer, especially.
Mm. I was surprised to learn that, you know, all of these texts that comprise the Philokalia, they weren't actually gathered together until 1782, and then it was published in Venice.
Yes.
Which is not a Greek-speaking city.
No, indeed. It was not.
So what happened?
Sure. It is a very interesting story how this came to be. So, as I said, the texts were written between the 300s and the 1500s, but they were kept in manuscripts, in libraries of monasteries in an area of Greece called Mount Athos, sometimes called the Holy Mountain, because there are several very large monasteries and a number of small kind of dependent hermitages, and it's kind of the single largest collection of monastics, male monastics in this case, in the Orthodox world. It's quite a unique and spectacular place. But by the 1700s, the monasteries were very poor and very much in decline, in part because under Ottoman rule, Christians had the position of second or even third class citizens.
Mm.
And so you weren't seeing theological works being produced. But by the mid-1700s, some people are really trying to get back to those kind of glory days of Byzantine theology and spirituality. And so on Mount Athos, we have people like the Romanian monk, St. Paisie Velichkovsky, who is gathering together texts on prayer from the manuscripts that are in the libraries and putting them together. At the same time, the Bishop of Corinth, now St. Macarius, St. Macarius of Corinth, commissions another monk named St. Nicodemus of Mount Athos to do the legwork of putting together an anthology of all the best texts on prayer that weren't already available. And it does seem that they kind of focused on things that hadn't been published. And it took them probably 20 years to put all this together. And he talks about these texts as writings that were never published in earlier times, that lay about in corners and holes and darkness and unknown and moth-eaten. Texts that people should be reading, but that no one reads anymore. And so they're going to put them together, and they're going to not copy them into a manuscript where only a few people could see it, but they're going to take advantage of the still relatively new technology of printing so that many people can access it. Now, that sounds like a great idea, but it's still the late 1700s in an Ottoman-controlled area, and it was illegal to publish Christian religious materials within the Ottoman Empire. And so St. Nicodemus and St. Macarius, they sent the collection that they made to Venice to be published in 1782, where there were a number of great printing houses. It's hard to say that it was a great success. A few copies were printed, maybe a couple of hundred at most. At the same time, St. Paisi, whom I mentioned earlier, he'd been collecting texts as well. He had returned to his monastery in Romania, and he published 11 years later a very similar, if not quite identical, collection called the Dobrotolubia, which is Slavonic, Church Slavonic, a kind of form of Russian, for, well, it means love of beauty, just, it's a transliteration of Philokalia into Slavonic. So he publishes the Dobrotolubia in 1793, and that one becomes more popular more quickly. So the Greek version doesn't really take off for another century. It's republished at the end of the 19th century and then really starts to see traction in the 20th century. But meanwhile, the Russian version is being read, and then we have this work, The Way of the Pilgrim, which portrays someone kind of living the life of the Philokalia, the practices of prayer that it describes, with great success. And that book is a huge success. And from there, the spirituality of the Philokalia in both its Greek and its Russian forms really begins to take off and spread throughout the Orthodox world, and it gets picked up more and more globally.
Yeah, so it wasn't really until it was seized upon by Slavic-speaking people that it became so important to Orthodox identity.
That's right. Yeah, it's really the Russian versions that became so important to how identity and spiritual practices were being understood, what it meant to be praying in an Orthodox way, what it meant to be living a life of prayer, came to be defined by the forms of prayer that are in the Philokalia, that are described in the Philokalia.
I mean, were there rival religious ideas and practices that were around at the time that threatened that Orthodox identity?
I don't know that there were exactly threats, but I think the practices of prayer that you find in the Philokalia are intensely personal and internal. It is an inward prayer, often undertaken silently. And that is always going to threaten certain kinds of institution and bureaucracy. It's going to be seen as a kind of revolutionary work, and that
why is that revolutionary? To pray silently is not a surprising thing to do today. Why is that a scandalous idea at the time?
Yeah, I suppose I don't want to overplay like, oh, you know, the big bad religious authorities were frightened of this. I don't think that's really true. I mean, there are moments where, I mean, the Russian Navy sent warships to fire water cannons at Athenite monks because they considered their practice of prayer and focus on the name heretical. So, I mean,
yeah, wow.
Yeah, that did happen. That is a thing that happened. And so you have this sense that the way in which people pray matters a great deal for how they see themselves as part of a community and whether they see themselves as part of a community and whether they are submitted to the authority of a bishop or whether they are doing something that can become an authority alongside or even against the bishop. And this is something that was an issue back in the 14th century when the rise of this particular kind of prayer, this inward prayer and stillness, which was called hesychasm. Hezekiah means stillness or silence in Greek, and hesychasm is the practice of still and silent prayer and of achieving a kind of inward stillness. The claims of the monks who were engaging in that were considered by many to be heretical and deeply problematic, and that they were claiming to know and experience God in ways that offended theological sensibilities and worried bishops. And so you do find church councils called in those years to try and determine whether this practice of prayer is acceptable or not. And some say yes and some say no. And it gets wrapped up with, I mean, basically the first council called on this condemns hesychasm and the inward prayer. And later, another council vindicates it, but this is only after that council is called by an emperor who overthrew his rival. And I think it does come back to where authority lies. And with a really inward practice of prayer, authority lies in the relationship between the praying person and God and perhaps their spiritual father. But that's sort of outside or at least alongside the more institutional forms of authority that one might expect to uphold.
Mm. I mean, it's, forgive me, it sounds almost a little bit Protestant, you know, like this relationship between you and God and not necessarily in a community.
I think one could see that as a potential outcome. I don't actually think that's what people are doing. I think that the people engaging in this prayer are deeply embedded in their communities, but those are the monasteries. But I think what I'd want to say is that there is a way in which this sounds Protestant, and there's a way in which I think someone worried about independence and independent spirituality might see it that way. But that actually the people engaging in these practices are so deeply formed by their monastic community, by their church community, by the liturgy that they share with other Christians, that it's not so much a revolution against the authority of the Orthodox churches, but a revolution in the way in which people find themselves and are formed within those churches. So it never becomes a separate entity. There is no hesychast church.
Right.
Right. There is the Orthodox church, and within that, the form of spirituality that people undertake and which is sanctioned by the church is hesychast, is focused on stillness and prayer. And so I think that could seem like, and it could certainly look like, it's going to become a sort of another Protestant Reformation that isn't the way it does go, though. And I think that is important to distinguish.
Mm. Tell me about the Jesus Prayer. How does that fit in to this style of prayer?
Right. I've been speaking quite generally about the practices of prayer found in the Philokalia, but what it really comes down to is the Jesus Prayer. And hesychasm, this practice of stillness and inward prayer, is also down to the Jesus Prayer. The Jesus Prayer is very short. It goes, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. That's it. That's the whole prayer. The point is not the length of the prayer. In fact, it's meant to be short. It's referred to sometimes as an arrow prayer, like one fires it like an arrow.
Hmm.
It's also called a brief or monologistos prayer. Just you can say it in a breath. But the practice of the Jesus Prayer is to repeat it endlessly, to repeat it all day. Whatever else one is doing, one can be saying the Jesus Prayer at first out loud, then silently. In the Philokalia, we read that as one grows in this practice of repeating the Jesus Prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, the sinner, one aligns the rhythm of the words to the rhythms of one's breathing, so that as you breathe in, you say part, and as you breathe out, you say part. And by doing it silently, it can become kind of, as they say, united to the breath. And as that happens, it begins to take on even the rhythm of one's heartbeat. And so it comes to be called the prayer of the heart.
Mm.
And the kind of more extravagant claim of the fathers in the Philokalia is that eventually the repetition becomes something that happens on its own. One doesn't have to consciously engage it. The prayer prays itself, or in a sense, the prayer prays the person rather than the person praying the prayer. And so one almost becomes the Jesus Prayer. And so a lot of what the texts of the Philokalia are describing is a practice of prayer that isn't bound to certain times or places. You know, one doesn't need to be in church or at liturgy or at Vespers or another service to do it. One can do it anytime. And so this becomes a way of practicing prayer that sort of spills over the boundaries of designated times and places. And the most extravagant claim, the real astonishing claim of the fathers of the Philokalia is that the effect of this prayer and of this practice of prayer is to deify the person praying, to make them divine. That not only does it become their heartbeat, it makes them like God. It purifies them, it illuminates them, it perfects them. And the full title of the Philokalia is, it is the Philokalia of the Watchful Fathers, in which are gathered texts useful for deification, for purification, illumination, and perfection. There's actually more to the title. It's a very long title. But the idea is that if one undertakes what is found in this collection, one will become like God to the extent possible. And that is a notion of salvation that is very much at the heart of Eastern Orthodox theology and has been for thousands of years at this point, ever since Athanasius of Alexandria in the 4th century said in his On the Incarnation that God became human that humans might become God. Mm. And since then, the understanding of what it means to be saved is worked out in terms of what it means to become God. And that's a bold claim. And the particular way in which this is understood among those who practice the Jesus Prayer or hesychast spirituality is that as one becomes divine, one comes to see not God, and this is where it gets tricky, not God essentially, but one does see what they call the uncreated light of God, which is understood to be the same as the light that the disciples saw when Jesus was transfigured on the mountain. That that when he shone with light, that is the uncreated light of God. It is a kind of eternal activity of God, and that this can be seen physically and experienced as light and warmth. Mm-hmm. You can see it then in later lives of very influential saints, like the Russian Saint Seraphim of Sarov. He describes sitting in the snow and only realizing afterward that he was even in the snow because he was so warm, and even only realizing later that it was night because it was so bright. You know, that this experience of God for the person being deified, and which deifies the person, is the ultimate goal of the prayer.
Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. It's short, accessible, and has shaped Orthodox prayer now for several centuries. On ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and ABC Listen, this is Soul Search. I'm Rowan Salmond, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Zecker, a historian of the Byzantine Empire and co-translator of a new translation of the Philokalia, a book cherished by Orthodox Christians and which encourages stillness and ceaseless prayer. There's an almost contradiction embedded in the history of the Philokalia, in that, at least on an Orthodox timescale, it was published relatively recently. The works it contains are much older, but you might find it surprising that for something so critical to this ancient church, it wasn't published until the late 1700s and didn't really become popular until 100 years after that.
Yes. So the collection itself, as you say, it's relatively recent. 1782 is not that long ago. The latest text in the Philokalia is 200 years older than the Philokalia. And the earliest text is, 1,300 years older. And it's also true that if you read through the Philokalia kind of in the order in which it's compiled, which is roughly chronological, you read those early texts, you won't hear anything about the Jesus Prayer, and you won't hear all that much about deification. You begin to hear more as you go along. And only when you get to some of the later material, really from the 14th century, and I talked about those councils and the controversies that surrounded hesychast spirituality. Well, that's because this is when it had really emerged as a movement. People hadn't talked about it in those ways before then. And so that's quite late too. Mm. But what those fathers understood themselves to be doing was not coming up with something new, not even really adding to what was already there, but delving deeper into what was already present and finding the meaning and the potential that was implicit in the tradition going all the way back. And so when Makarios of Corinth and Nicodemus of Athos compile this, they don't see themselves as making anything new at all. In fact, I don't think they'd like that idea. Orthodoxy doesn't care for innovation, you see.
I see.
The old joke goes, how many Orthodox does it take to change a light bulb? Change, right? You know, the idea is we don't want to change. We don't want to innovate. And so, yeah, so they wouldn't have seen themselves as doing that, but rather reaching into tradition and finding what was already present. And that's kind of the point of the Philokalia, that putting these texts together is as much a way of saying that the spirituality of hesychasm, the practice of the Jesus prayer, the claim to see the uncreated light of God, these are traditional. These are ancient. It's saying that they were there all along, even if they weren't obviously there. And so the collection is making the statement that what seems new is actually ancient, and that what appears an innovation is actually tradition. And there is a tension in that, because there is something new in doing that. Mm. The creation of the collection is something new. but that's a good kind of new. It's a kind of creativity that works within the boundaries of tradition. And it's the kind of creativity that you see happening throughout that same tradition, that all these authors, as they're writing, see themselves doing kind of the same thing, as going back to what they know to be true and reflecting on it in their own way. And in doing so, yes, they add something, their own voice, but they're always singing the same chorus, and they certainly understand themselves as doing so. And of course, even for the earliest ones, what they're going back to is scripture. Hmm. And this, the tradition of prayer that develops is one that is always guided by a sense of antiquity and fidelity to tradition.
Hmm. What's your relationship to this book?
Long and complicated. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of people in the English-speaking world, I first encountered the Philokalia before I knew much about Eastern Orthodox Christianity itself. I came to it because a friend gave me the book The Way of the Pilgrim, that short Russian story of a pilgrim who decides to abandon everything to practice the Jesus prayer, and who is given the Philokalia to read by his spiritual father. It's a fictional story that kind of embodies the essence of how spirituality, and especially hesychast spirituality, was thought to work ideally by these kind of Russian revivalists. And I read that, and I was quite inspired by it. And so I thought I would try it. I'd get myself a prayer rope, which is a bit like a rosary, but for every bead on it or every knot in it, you just say the Jesus prayer. Mm. And I thought I'd try that. And only later did I really kind of come to the Orthodox Church and convert.
So you weren't raised Orthodox?
No, I was raised very American evangelical, kind of non-denominational Bible church. So for me, this was a very different world, to say the
right,
least.
Yes.
But it's one that I really loved. I mean, I for one, fell in love with the sense of tradition and antiquity and the beauty of the liturgy and the prayers and the hymns and all of it, and the iconography, certainly. So I quite enjoyed all of that and appreciated it. But then I came to spend a lot more time with the Philokalia itself, first as part of my doctoral work. My supervisor, Father Andrew Louth, who's the other translator on this and the editor, really, he is really a leading expert in the Philokalia, and as well as an Orthodox priest. Effectively, he asked me to come on board with him to do this translation, which I should say, it's what we have done is not a complete translation at all. We've offered about a fifth
Philokalia is very long.
It is. There is a complete English translation. It's five long volumes from Faber and Faber. But what Father Andrew and I have done, and the way we see our translation, is as an invitation to readers who aren't yet ready to sit down with five long volumes and who might want to just taste it and see how they like it. We hope that they'll taste it and they'll like the taste and they will want to keep going. So we always recognize the relationship with and really the debt to Metropolitan Callistos' and others' translation.
So yours is more accessible than the other?
We've aimed for that, yes.
Yeah.
Certainly our approach to the translation has been different than theirs.
Okay.
So those who are already familiar with their translation will find ours, I think, a bit different at points. We avoid some of the words like noetic or energies in favor of words like spiritual or intellectual and activities. So a kind of real plain English approach as much as possible, which felt was important to capturing kind of the fact that it's plain Greek, that it was written in, even if a rather literary Greek. We've otherwise, at points, gone perhaps more literal, and at points a bit more English friendly or idiomatic, and so it's just a very different translation than what was available before. So readers will also hopefully enjoy the difference between the two and find between them, you know, food for thought.
And what was it like spending so long thinking about this text? Did it change your relationship to this book that you have clearly been reading for many years and reflecting on for many years?
It did.
Yeah.
It did. In a lot of ways. I mean, first and foremost, I think my real education in Greek came through the work of translating this. It took me about 4 years to do the drafting, and then it's taken another six to actually finish the publishing. So really learning the language and getting to know, maybe more than that, the people behind the language, to come to see them as, I don't know if I'd call them friends exactly, that feels optimistic, but certainly people that I'm very well acquainted with. I feel like when I read them now, it's a little more like I'm having a conversation with someone than it used to be. It feels a little less exotic, a little less foreign, a little more familiar. At the same time, I think for me, as for anyone, you know, this is a professional process that's inevitably entangled with one's personal life. And so all the ups and downs and travels of my own life have been in some ways filtered through the work of translating the Philokalia. So it feels like I've found a bit of myself in this as well, which I think is good. I think it's meant to do that, to see oneself through encountering these fathers.
Did it change how you pray?
That's a really good question. Yes, it has changed the way I've prayed. I think it has, at the very least, challenged me and not let me take prayer for granted.
The Philokalia was made, compiled for monastics, but clearly, you know, ordinary people, lay people, have gotten a lot from it as well. What does it have to say to ordinary Orthodox Christians today? What is it in the Philokalia that challenges maybe the patterns of our lives that might not have existed when it was written?
While the texts that compose the Philokalia were written primarily by and usually for monastics, St. Nicodemus is very clear in his introduction that this is actually for everyone. And some of the very late texts, like by St. Simeon of Thessaloniki, they say, you know, this is really for everybody. And that's because it doesn't require anyone to be a monastic to do. That's actually the beauty of the Jesus Prayer, is that, as I said before, you don't need a particular time or place to do it. It becomes the rhythm of one's life. Because it can be done at any time, silently, there's really nothing that can't be accompanied by the prayer and the practice of prayer of the Philokalia. And so it's adaptable to any situation in a way that a lot of perhaps liturgical prayer would be more difficult to adapt. This can be done anywhere and has been. You know, we have accounts of people in prison camps, in Gulag and others, engaged deeply in the Jesus Prayer. People working your average, 9 to 5 can be praying the Jesus Prayer. I have tried it while packing jewelry at a temp job for a online shopping company. Nice. It was great. So that is what I think works so well about it. At the same time, it does challenge, especially situations where we would tend to fill those moments with noise and images. It is not compatible with doom scrolling, for example. not much is compatible with doom scrolling, certainly not a thriving existence.
And it's a relief to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, speaking as someone guilty of far too much, I know this to be true. Mm. And so in that sense, it's not adaptable to it. It's an antidote to it. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the texts that were put together, I mean, they were written in a myriad of situations. Yeah, the people were usually monks, but they were different kinds of monks. Some of them lived in a community with maybe 100 other monks all, eating together and praying together and sleeping in a dormitory. Others might have been living very much on their own. Still others were bishops. I mean, Simeon of Thessaloniki, he spent 8 years of his bishopric in the siege of Thessaloniki, trying to stave off starvation. Others were writing in periods of war or famine. The end of the Byzantine Empire is a terribly unpleasant time, as the end of any empire would be. It's mostly war, famine, and mass murder.
And violence, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, these people write a spirituality of stillness, but their lives weren't still. Mm. They weren't in ideal conditions for this at all. And I think that is testimony enough that it doesn't need to be the same conditions. One doesn't have to be a monastic in the same way or have the kind of ideal life for prayer. In fact, maybe it's when one's life isn't an ideal life for prayer that it really can thrive, that it becomes the antidote or the way of transcending turmoil and violence and struggle and uncertainty and anxiety, which is true of so many of the lives that gave us these writings. They were times of deep uncertainty, deep anxiety, and often violence and great personal cost. They knew what it was to live uncertain lives, and this was the spirituality that they thought needed to be known.
Mm. I mean, the asceticism really jumps out, actually, mm-hmm. and it's such a strong theme of Orthodox Christian belief and practice, which I wonder if, today in the West, at least, the abundance and the relative safety, or at least in Australia, it's a challenge to that situation that we are in.
I think it is. I think it's always meant to be a challenge. That asceticism, the term ascesis means training and discipline. It's not necessarily saying that one has to always be deprived of things, but that one doesn't take anything for granted, or that one doesn't assume that one is entitled to anything, that you don't get attached to things as though you deserved them. You learn how to let go, and the only way to let go is to force yourself to let go, and that's what asceticism really requires, that periods of fasting, and in the Orthodox world, periods of fasting mean periods of effectively going vegan. Mm. These are not meant to deny the goodness of food or anything like that, but to create a right relationship with food, that learning disciplines of prayer create good habits of interacting also with others, that all the techniques of asceticism are there to form the kind of person who doesn't approach things as a competition for resources and who can enjoy hard times as well as good, who thinks of abundance in terms of spiritual abundance rather than material abundance. And so it's always going to be a challenge to any society that prioritizes material prosperity, wealth, abundance, and the kind of competitive spirit of capitalism.
Mm. Just finally, if one were to crack open the Philokalia, where would you start? What do you recommend for somebody, you know, living an ordinary life in Australia somewhere? What's the bit that you think is a good entry point?
It's a tough one because there is no easy entry point to the Philokalia. All of the texts are pretty dense and pretty demanding. But the ones that maybe really stand out to me, and the ones that made me really kind of fall in love with it, I would say St. Diaticus of Photiki, this text called 100 Gnostic Chapters, or St. Maximus the Confessor's 400 Chapters on Love. Now, that sounds very long. I should say each of those chapters is about a sentence or two long.
Yeah, it's about a line, yes.
Yes, and that's important. But a pretty good place to start. This is from St. Diaticus. This is the 77th of his 100 chapters, and I'll just read a bit. Grace, as I have said, from the very moment of our baptism, is hidden deep in the depth of our intellect, concealing its own coming, even from the intellect's perception itself. But when someone begins with full resolve to love God, then, by an ineffable word, grace communicates to the soul, through the intellect's perception, some portion of its own good things. Thereafter, one who wants to possess what has been discovered with full assurance comes, by joyfully desiring to renounce all present goods, truly to procure the field in which he will find buried the treasure of life. For when anyone renounces everything that passes for wealth in this life, then he finds the place in which God's grace has been concealed. For the divine gift manifests its own goodness to the intellect in accordance with the soul's progress. And just this sense of beauty, of illumination, of grace, that there is progress and requirement, but that there is also always the cooperation and assistance of God. That runs right through the Philokalia, and that is what makes its practices of prayer work and make sense. So I tend to like St. Diaticus for things like that, and St. Maximus especially. But then people can dip in anywhere, and they will find it all, I hope, rich and provocative and probably challenging. And that's a good thing, too.
Hmm. Well, Jonathan, thank you for speaking to me about this. I've learned so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me for this conversation. It's been really wonderful to get to reflect on the Philokalia together.
The Hesychastic Spirituality of the Philokalia and the Jesus Prayer. Perhaps a challenge for those in comfort and abundance, and a comfort to those suffering turmoil and war. Jonathan Zecca is a historian of late antiquity and the Byzantine Empire, and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University. He's also co-translator of a new translation of the Philokalia, and we'll have more information about that in this episode's show notes on the Soul Search website. This episode of Soul Search was recorded on Gadigal land. Thanks to producer Hong Jiang and executive producer Noel DeBian. I'm Rowan Salmond. Don't forget, you can email me at soul.search@abc.net.au. I'll catch you next time for Soul Search on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.